Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
Hello, brothers and sisters, comrades and friends. This is Siegfried. I've been AWOL for some time now. Longtime listeners of Back in the USSR may have noticed there's been a lot of reruns of past episodes. Over the past year, I had to take a hiatus for reasons that I'm not going to go into here. But I'm back now, and there is plenty to discuss. So thank you for joining me on Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. Obviously, the Ukraine war is continuing. A war that was entirely preventable. A war that did not need to happen. Starting with the overthrow of the democratically elected Ukrainian government by far-right political forces openly supported by the United States in 2014. And the resultant outbreak of a civil war in eastern Ukraine. There have been multiple opportunities for peace in that country that were systematically sabotaged. The US pressured Ukraine not to abide by the 2015 and 2016 Minsk Accords that were supposed to end the conflict. The US categorically refused to negotiate with Russia in the critical months before the conflict escalated in February 2022. and the efforts of the Russians and Ukrainians to negotiate a peaceful end to hostilities in March 2022. And by April of last year, they were very close to a deal. You know, they'd sat down and they'd negotiated with each other in Istanbul, capital of, in the, you know, the, one of the key cities of Turkey. And those talks were likewise undermined and ultimately scuppered, you know, destroyed by Western governments that were eager to keep the war going. You know, I believe it was the Prime Minister of Britain at the time, Boris Johnson, who literally flew into Kiev and basically said, if you make peace with the Russians, we're going to pull the plug on any aid we give you. You know, you will no longer have our political support. And the government of Ukraine caved and walked away. And so the war went on. The war escalated. And what we see in Ukraine today is a American empire using the bodies of the Ukrainian people as a meat shield. As a meat shield against a geopolitical adversary. It's a classic imperialist proxy war, and Washington, frankly, doesn't care if hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians have to die for it to secure its strategic objectives in Eastern Europe. You know, full stop. Full stop. They don't care. But I've talked about that at length on this show last year. You know, there's something else that demands attention tonight. A brave man's sacrifice for his people, living under one of the world's most brutal occupation regimes. I'm speaking of Kadir Adnan. He was 45 years old when he died on May 2nd, 2023, after 85 days on hunger strike in an Israeli prison. Like so many Palestinians placed under administrative detention by the Israeli authorities, he was never charged with a crime. And like Bobby Sands, the Irish hunger striker who gave his life on May 5th, 1981, after 66 days, Kadir Adnan fought his oppressors to the end. And this is what Bethlehem-based journalist Yumna Patel of Mondovice had to say about Adnan's case, and it provides an excellent overview. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
I want to bring up some really, actually, very tragic news. The death of Sheikh Kadir Adnan, the Palestinian political prisoner who just died Tuesday morning after an 87-day hunger strike. We actually have an image of him. This is him when he's healthy with some of his children. And then this is an image of him once he had started his hunger strike. What do people need to know about him?
Thanks. Yeah, I'm actually really glad that you brought up Kadir Adnan's case. What people need to know, I mean, there's a lot of things that people need to know about Kadir Adnan, one of which is, you know, before his death and now certainly after his death, he has become an icon of Palestinian resistance to Israeli oppression. I mean, Kadir Adnan was only 45 years old, and this was at least the 11th time that he had been arrested and imprisoned by the Israelis. Over the past 18 years, eight of those years, more or less, were spent behind bars. And what's really important to note about Kadir Adnan's story is that for much of his detention, including his most recent detention, over which he went on strike and over which, you know, because he died over it, is his most recent detention was under a policy called administrative detention, which is this policy that Israel uses almost exclusively against Palestinians to imprison people without charge or trial. So Kadir Adnan was in prison for almost 3 months. He's been on hunger strike for almost 3 months. He died as a result of this hunger strike, and he was never formally charged with a crime. He was never indicted. He never had his day in court. He was never put on trial. This thing that we talk about called due process was something that he was never afforded. And his case is definitely an exceptional case, but it's by no means a unique case. I mean, there are thousands of Palestinians over the years who have been put under, have been imprisoned for months and even years under this policy of administrative detention. And currently, there are dozens of Palestinians, including children, who are being imprisoned by Israeli authorities under under this policy. And so what happened to Khadr Adnan, the fact that he had to starve himself to death in protest of this extremely inhumane policy is, it's not something that should be taken lightly. And, you know, Israel essentially imprisoned him over his political affiliations because he was affiliated with the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement, which Israel and the U.S. considered to be a terror group, though they could never actually prove or never had any concrete evidence that Khadr Adnan actually participated in any of the military decisions or the military wing of Islamic Jihad. It was all basically suspicions of his involvement and his political affiliation. So you essentially have a man who was imprisoned for a significant portion of his life simply over his political affiliations. And eventually he was killed for it and he starved to death for it.
What were his demands?
So his demands, I mean, first and foremost, were to end Israel's, you know, targeted harassment campaign against him, which had been ongoing for several decades, an end to the policy of administrative detention and imprisoning Palestinians without charge or trial. Very, you know, simple demands, an end to his arbitrary arrest and detention. And also Khadr Adnan's wider demands over the years have been demands for the rights of Palestinian prisoners, and overall for, you know, he's, even in his death and his will, he's called for freedom and liberation for the Palestinian people. I mean, so yes, he was striking for his own well-being and his own freedom, but always within his strikes, this most recent one and over the years, he very much was striking for the rights of all Palestinians and for the freedoms of all Palestinians. And that's a message that he solidified in his final will and testament most recently in his death.
And the Israeli forces are holding his body. They're not giving his body to his family.
Yeah. So the most recent, I mean, as far as I know, unless things have changed in the past, you know, hour or so, as far as we know, the Israeli government is still continuing to hold his body and is refusing to release it to his family for burial. And again, this seems like such an exceptionally cruel kind of policy. You know, you imprison someone without ever charging them or convicting them of anything. They go on hunger strike, they die, and then you refuse to release their body even for, you know, their family to have a proper burial. But this is a very common policy and a very common tactic used by Israeli occupation forces. It's one used against Palestinians who are accused of committing attacks against Israelis. And it's also used against Palestinian political prisoners who die in prison. More often than not, Israeli authorities will hold the body of the prisoner to serve out their sentence, basically. If they die in the middle of a 20-year sentence, they might say, well, we're not going to release the body for another X amount of years until they've completed the sentence. In the case of Khadr Adnan, you know, he never actually had an allotted sentence, but they're still holding his body. And this is, you know, very commonly understood as just another torture tactic for the Palestinian people and for Palestinian families to continue to suppress any sort of, you know, resistance to the Israeli occupation or to Israeli oppression. And so despite calls from the ICRC and other human rights organizations, Israel is still refusing to release his body. And it's important to note, finally, that for Muslims, the burial of Muslims is very sacred, and there's a very, you know, strict process that people adhere to. And one of the tenets of Islamic burials is being able to bury your loved one basically as fast and as soon as possible. Oftentimes people are buried within hours of the time that they pass away. And so there's another added level of cruelty in this, in that Israel is not only denying this family the ability to say goodbye to their loved one, but they're also denying their religious right to bury their loved one according to their religious practices. Yeah.
It says Dr. Lina Kadem Hassan, the chair of Physicians for Human Rights Israel, visited Adnan on 23 April, after which the organization issued an urgent call for the prisoner to be transferred to hospital. for monitoring and emergency intervention. An Israeli court recently rejected two PHRI petitions demanding Adnan be transferred to a hospital and that his family be visited to be permitted to visit him. Quote, his cognitive function was good enough to talk to me, but he was very weak, losing consciousness regularly. He was clearly dying, she said. He said he wanted to live. It doesn't matter what medical colleagues thought about him or that he refused help. Their job is to save lives. The guidelines for dealing with hunger strikers are clear. He should have been taken to hospital after day 45.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Israel loves to pride itself in its, you know, humanitarianism and medical technology and treatment.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is something that happens a lot. I mean, this gross medical negligence that happens in the case of Palestinian prisoners. Again, this isn't a unique case. This is actually a tried and true policy of the Israeli authorities when it comes to Palestinian prisoners who are hunger striking in order to, you know, secure their release from prison or to achieve a number of other demands. So in the case of Khadr Adnan, in violation or in, you know, contravention of international norms or what should have been done, he wasn't transferred to a hospital despite the rapid deterioration of his physical health. He was kept inside the Israel a prison clinic, which is, you know, notoriously which is notorious for not meeting the medical needs and not meeting the standards of medical care that is necessary for sick prisoners and for hunger-striking prisoners. So that's also why his family and largely for the Palestinian people, this case is exceptionally cruel in the sense that people aren't just taking this as, oh, you know, he went on hunger strike and he died. Khadr Adnan is being regarded as a martyr and someone who was killed. And some people are even saying he was executed, you know, by the Israeli government, because, you know, it wasn't just he went on hunger strike. He was given all the proper medical care and he died. It was he went on hunger strike in protest of his arbitrary detention. He shouldn't have been in prison in the first place. He went on strike. And then on top of that, there was gross medical negligence and malpractice that happened that had that directly correlated to his death. And on top of that, the rights of his family were also violated, you know, not being able to visit him, not being able to see him, and not being able to ensure that he was getting the care that he needed.
I should also add, though, that he's not even the only person killed by Israeli forces or Israeli institutions this week. Mm-hmm. We also have, at least that I know of, 17-year-old Jibril Mohammed Syed Kamal. He was shot Monday. He was shot in the head with live ammunition in Akbat Jabbar refugee camp near Jericho in the West Bank. So there he is. And there were also people killed last week. I just don't even have time to go through all the people killed, especially since this year alone.
Yeah, I mean, this year, I mean, every day, right? This is an everyday reality. Someone's killed somewhere. Over the past year, we've seen an exceptional increase in violence and the excessive use of, you know, lethal force against Palestinians in the West Bank. Last year, at the end of last year, we did a big piece for Mondo Weiss on all the Palestinians who had been killed in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. The number that we came out, you know, there were a difference in numbers, but the number that we came out with, according to our documentation, was that at least 173 Palestinians had been killed in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem last year. And that was by Israeli soldier and settler violence. And the reason that, you know, people might have seen a lot of headlines, including our headlines last year, saying that a record number of people were killed was because last year we saw the highest number of Palestinians killed in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem over, you know, since the Second Intifada, basically. And now this year, we are on track to far surpass the already record-breaking numbers of last year. I mean, so far, we're right at the beginning of the fifth month of the year. We're not even halfway in the year, and more than 105 Palestinians have already been killed this year. And so, yes, Khadr Adnan and the teenager who was killed also in the Akbat Jabbar refugee camp, they are not alone. They're one of many Palestinians who have already been, you know, more than 100 who have already been killed this year. And it's all part of this growing and, you know, worrying trend of the increase of lethal force and excessive force used against Palestinians by Israeli soldiers and also by Israeli settlers who are increasingly becoming more armed, more violent, and being emboldened by, you know, the right-wing fascist government that Israel currently has in power. So all of this is, you know, coming into play together to create a very unsafe situation for Palestinians on the ground who are living under Israeli military occupation.
I am standing on the threshold of another trembling world. May God have mercy on my soul. My heart is very sore because I know that I have broken my poor mother's heart, and my home is struck with unbearable anxiety. But I have considered all the arguments and tried every means to avoid what has become the unavoidable. It has been forced upon me and my comrades by 4.5 years of stark inhumanity. I am a political prisoner. I am a political prisoner because I am a casualty of a perennial war that is being fought between the oppressed Irish people and an alien, oppressive, unwanted regime that refuses to withdraw from our land. I believe and stand by the God-given right of the Irish nation to sovereign independence and the right of any Irishman or woman to assert this right in armed revolution. That is why I am incarcerated, naked, and tortured. Foremost in my tortured mind is the thought that there can never be peace in Ireland until the foreign oppressive British presence is removed, leaving all the Irish people as a unit to control their own affairs and determine their own destinies as a sovereign people, free in mind and body, separate and distinct physically, culturally, and economically. I believe I am but another of those wretched Irishmen born of a risen generation with a deeply rooted and unquenchable desire for freedom. I am dying, not just to attempt to end the barbarity of H-Block, or to gain the rightful recognition of a political prisoner, but primarily because what is lost in here is lost for the Republic, and those wretched, oppressed, whom I am deeply proud to know as the risen people. You're listening to Back in the USSR on 93.3 FM CFRU. That reading was taken from the diary of Bobby Sands for March 1st, 1981, the day that he began his hunger strike against the brutal prison regime of the British occupation authorities in Northern Ireland. He kept that diary going for 17 of his 66 days on hunger strike. I read from it today as a statement of solidarity with Khadr Adnan, the recently fallen Palestinian hunger striker, and all others who continue to fight for the freedom of Palestine and the Palestinian people. The Palestinian people, like the Irish people, have resisted occupation and colonization in every conceivable way. They discovered, like the Irish, that peaceful protest won't stop the occupiers from shooting you down in the streets or arbitrarily detaining you for years on end, without charges, like Khadr Adnan was. Like Yumna Patel said in our previous segment, at least 105 Palestinians have been killed so far this year, many of them civilians. I'm recording this on May 7th, the anniversary of the final assault by the Vietnamese army against the colonial French forces at the Battle of Dien Bien Phu on May 7, 1954. This crushing defeat forced the French to abandon Vietnam and their other Asian colonies. Last month, there was the anniversary of the fall of Saigon in 1975, when the American military was at last kicked out of Vietnam after their bloody drawn-out efforts to dominate the country. No occupation can be maintained indefinitely. And the same is true for Palestine. Palestinian political forces are increasingly united against the Israeli occupation and resistance is growing both in scale and effectiveness. Just like the resistance against apartheid South Africa, resistance against apartheid Israel takes many forms, but all of it combined brings the colonial regime closer to collapse. And to emphasize this point further, in a way that only poetry can, I'd like to play one of Bobby Sands' most beloved pieces, The Rhythm of Time.
There's an inner thing in every man. Do you know this thing, my friend? It has withstood the blows of a million years and will do so to the end. It was born when time did not exist, and it grew up out of life. It cut down evil, strangling veins like a slashing, searing knife. It lit fires when fires were not, and burnt the mind of men, tempering leaden hearts to steel from the time that time began. It wept by the waters of Babylon, and when all men were a loss, it screeched in writhing agony, and it hung bleeding from the cross. It died in Rome by land and sword in defiant, cruel array, when the deathly word was Spartacus along the Appian Way. It marched with what the tailors poor, and frightened lord and king, and it was emblazoned in their deathly stir as ere a living thing. It smiled in holy innocence before conquistadors of old, so meek and tame and unaware of the deathly power of gold. It burst forth through pitiful Paris streets and stormed the old Bastille and marched upon the serpent's head and crushed it neath its heel. It died in blood on buffalo plains and starved by moons of rain. Its heart was buried in wounded knee, but it will come to rise again. It screamed along by Kerry Lakes as it knelt upon the ground, and it died in great defiance as they coldly shut it down. It is found in every light of hope, it knows no bounds nor space. It has risen in red and black and white, it is there in every race. It lies in the hearts of heroes dead, it screams in tyrant's eyes. It has reached the peaks of mountain high, it comes searing across the skies. It lights the dark of this prison cell, it thunders forth its might. It is the undauntable thought, my friend, that thought that says I'm right.
By 1976, the conflict in the north of Ireland had claimed over 1,500 lives. In its war against the Republican movement, the British government's focus shifted to the prisons. All those convicted after 1st of March 1976 were to be treated as criminals and held in a new prison, the H Blocks.
They tried here to force the prison gear on me in the reception area. I resisted.
And he said, put uniform on. And I said, not putting uniform on because I'm a political prisoner. And that were no prison uniform.
It went without saying Republican prisoners did not view themselves as criminals. Never did, and they never will.
Government standing against the wall and strip off and put my clothes under a brown bag. And I'd strip down my underpants. And the guy came out again and says, I said strip, get the fucking heap off. So I shoved off naked through the underpants into the bag.
You're standing in the circle in front of all these screws, forced to strip naked, until you were just all the usual snide remarks, the jeers, the jokes, all the usual rubbish coming from.
There can be no question of political status for someone who is serving a sentence for crime. Crime is crime is crime. It is not political, it is crime.
The talk was that H3 was not the block to go to. If you could avoid H3, you'd be doing all right. I just heard them shouting, H3. And I just remember, oh God, you know. That's what I didn't want.
I was trailed by the hair, kicked into the classroom. I was stripped naked. They threw me a towel. They gave me a towel. And even when I was trying to walk with a towel, I kept pulling the towel off me when they'd bring me down to the cell.
I can remember walking down the wing, and you feel very awkward for a start if you're walking no clothes and no shoes on, so it's a bit awkward walking anyway. But the other thing was, you know, what do you do with your hands? Do you put them over your braves as if you're... Then that feels as if you're embarrassed, you know, but at the same time you're not going to sort of march down the wing, you know, your arms are there, because that's not how you're feeling either. So I remember sort of feeling, you know, your hands were like lumps of lead just by your side somewhere, you know.
Refusing to wear the uniform, the men wrapped themselves in blankets to hide their nakedness. And so began the blanket protest. It was to become one of the most remarkable prison protests in history. This is the story of the men who lived it, what gave them hope, how they lifted their morale, and what kept their spirits alive.
In the H blocks, you were locked in a cell, and because you were a protesting prisoner at that particular stage, at the early stage of protest, you were able to get out of your cell and go to the toilet. That was about it. If you took a visit, you were able to get out of your cell. If you went to mass, you could get out of your cell. Other than that, we were confined to our cells 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, etc. So I remember, this is me. I mean, here, this is me, this is the H blocks.
I think the first number of years, you're still very much ahead, still very much on the outside. So it's a Saturday night, you're thinking about what you would have been doing on a Saturday night, or what your mates are now doing, or you'd be thinking about your family, or what was going on there, or the places you would start to go, because you're starting to hear new things and be curious about things. So now it's about also the things you would do which you never would have thought of when you're outside. So the outside world is a big occupation. The thing is, I mean, I'd have pissed up and down the cell for about 10 hours a day, and that's a, you know, that's a lot of time to be, and you're just thinking thoughts, imaginary thoughts. You're doing things about Irish and such like, but you'd end up, I suppose, holding totally imaginary conversations with different people, maybe people who are in the jail but you don't have access to, or people who are on the outside. So it's, yeah, in many ways, it's, you create a bit of an imaginary world in your head.
To defeat the system, they would need to be able to dictate the pace of the protest. Escalation was inevitable. Confined to their cells, the immediate enemy became the prison staff, and the authorities would seek every opportunity to undermine their spirit.
Food and tobacco were things that definitely affected the morale of the wing. The particular screw in charge of the wing, his policy was, well, there wasn't brutality, it was to generally starve us. Like, the portions were just outrageous. You know, you could literally count the number of cornflakes on the bowl. The bowls themselves were smaller than in any other block. They were like saucers. So you could maybe count it. Somebody one morning shouted over, I think it was Sean Coleman, he had 11 cornflakes, and this was mixed with milk and water, you know, the water down the milk. In the evening, you got a cup of tea and cake, and it was just yellow cake that used to come round, that a lot of people hated. And it's funny because Kieran Dougherty, who died in the hunger strike, used to be saying that anybody doesn't want the yellow cake, to swing it up to him. And at that time, there was no windows. It smashed the windows, and they were open, so you could... The bit of a towel that we used wasn't a towel, it was a piece of like a white linen, but you could use it to put your arm out and swing from one cell to another. So like, people would actually have swung down the yellow cake down to Big Duck. I think it was the idea of just having something to eat rather than nothing.
Amid a dispute over the issue of slopping out, the protest was to reach new levels as prisoners resorted to the drastic step of covering their cells in excreta. Their actions put the prison authorities on the back foot and boosted the prisoners' morale. They seemed capable of enduring even the most inhumane of living conditions.
There was different ways of just dumping it out the window. There was options of maybe leaving it lying in a pen in the corner. You had maggots and stuff like that there because of the good weather. You had food dumped in the corner, so bread, maggots, blue bottles and all that there. So we decided the only place to put it was on the wall. It meant that it dried quickly. It also meant that you had to break off a piece of your mattress. When your shit went on the wall, I mean, the most embarrassing thing for me personally was having to sit in a corner with another person, another male person, no less than 5 or 6 feet away from me. So what I did, and I just did it, I couldn't have done it any other way. When I needed to use the toilet, I brought my own mattress and sort of covered myself off and give myself a wee bit of privacy. And I also believe that was given the other person, because going to the toilet, it's pungent, the smell straight away, you know, so you need to get to the toilet quickly, clean yourself, and then get a piece of mattress broke off that's enough to put on without getting it all over your hands, and get that up onto the wall ASAP. People start at different places. It would start up beside where they sleep, where their head would be, so as it's done and dusted quickly, or they'd start away down at the far end beside the door. People put it on in big clumps, people spread it out, people did designs. There was loads of ingenuity around putting a piece of shit in the wall. It was hard to believe, like, and we got a bit of a laugh out of that, you know, when people told us about their artwork and stuff like that, and you sit and you pick out faces, you pick out figures. Loads of stuff like that happened, you know, and that was always a bit of cracking, you know, and then there was always a slagging about being in a cell with a countryman. You were in real deep trouble, you know, because they were big lads and they did big number twos and stuff like that there.
The administration responded by transferring prisoners to new wings in order to clean the dirtied cells. Once in the corridors outside their confinement, the prisoners were at their most vulnerable as a policy of brutalization was implemented. Through beatings, mirror searches, and forced washing, the strength of their will was pushed to the limit. The battle for political status was to be hard fought, with the authorities intent on breaking those who would not conform to the prison regime.
You could hear the boys getting beat, you could hear the squeeze, the kicking, the punching. I mean, the whole waiting game again, it was a whole psychological thing too, you know. Sometimes it wasn't as bad as you were here, but the screws were squealing and bawling, they were banging the grill, so you couldn't see what was happening.
People are panicking. It's a free-for-all. It's just, it's you and about 15 screws, and it's you getting from that wing to the other ring in one piece, and depending what screws over the mirror, you know, it depends on the beating you're going to get.
They had a mirror. They used to set it on the ground. They used to ask you to stand over the mirror. We refused, so they'd physically here put you over the mirror. They'd have squatted you over it and pushed you down.
And you had these screws probing at you, and see, at the end of the day, to me, they were lowering themselves. I just said to myself, me, they're disgusting. They're worse than an animal. You know, they were trying to break me. What they were trying to do, you know, all the blanket men knew what they were trying to do, so that was the focus on me. My attitude was to me, you're not going to break me. You can kick me over them where it's 24/7. It doesn't really matter to me. You're degrading yourselves, you know what I mean? What does your family think? You know, what does your son, your daughter, your mother think if they see you doing that to another human being? It's a thing, you know, that blanket man, you know, the day, you know, would get very emotional over it, you know what I mean? I mean, get over it, and say to this day, you know what I mean, it still sends snowy shivers to you. You know, hard people could do it, you know, I couldn't do it. You know, I mean, the British government, the British army, screws, they were all our enemy, they're still our enemy at the time, we're still fighting a war to try and get the British out of the iron, but at the end of the day, you know, to lower yourself that, you know, I mean, they degraded themselves.
Next thing we heard the feet coming down the wing, and they passed my cell and went to the north cell, wee Joe McNulty from Tyrone. And Joe refused to leave the cell, and they piled in the cell and they kicked them and they trailed them up the wing and were booting them. I could see them outside the door passing my door. There's that many around them, you could hardly see Joe, but they were booting and punching them. And next thing we heard the feet, screws coming again, past my cell again, back down in the back in the Joe's cell. And we got Martin Horson. Martin was in the cell with Joe. And the trail Martin and the bait Martin. Martin was squealing, we're baiting him. Sexy thing that Joe got. And the next thing down the wing again, and they said Loudon, he's in here. Yeah, maybe it's my turn, right? I just sat down on the floor and he opened the door. About 5 or 6 of them, all guy running at the door, just ready to pounce in. I said, doctor. I mean, don't want to see a doctor. And I just dove in. And the way I was sitting, they just trailed me from her from behind, right out in my face, up the wing, and they booted me in the nose and the mouth. My nose busted open and trailed me in the big cell, and they were punching me. There was a chair sitting in the middle of the lawn. The feet on the chair, and they held you down with your hands and your feet. One of them started using the scissors that cut the bits of long hair off, and then used the shears. And I started, they're cutting you in the face, everything. You're taking lumps already. And they're all laughing, they're grabbing your hair and going, not that there, look, scalped Indians, yo! That man, scalping, look what I got, Loudon's hair. They had a bath on them, and the bath was freezing, ice cold water. They were holding us under the water, with our heads under the water, and you were struggling for a breath, and they were laughing, they were pulling you up, and they were laughing. Not of them, can't breathe. They just run me back to the cell, opened my cell door, and threw me in. And me, Hector, was sitting there, and he just looked at me. I looked at Hector. And this time, two just bust out laughing. Fuck that. He was just, fuck that. He said, thank fuck, it wasn't me. He mean, it'd probably be you tomorrow.
I often thought during the protest, if you'd wake up some morning and your hope had gone, then, I mean, you would realize you're living in a hellhole here. Walls covered in shit. You're barefoot. You're naked. There's no windows in it, it's cold, you're hungry. You just despair. Most can live through that and endure it, and they have a belief that something's going to happen. I guess that belief it's going to happen, but they end up losing that belief, that hope. Then all of that brutality just becomes so much more intensified. Like, I remember after wing shifts, someone saying, got up the door and saying, there's maybe a bad wing shift, and a lot of people beaten up. Well, sure, there'd be bad days for these good ones.
For some, the brutality and conditions had taken their toll. As the protest wore on, numbers began to fall.
I mean, everybody's got their weaknesses, everybody's got their strengths. We had that individual inner strength in everybody. Where, I mean, my attitude was, I just built a ring at the fence around myself. You know, my attitude was, I'm doing the blanket, I'm not going to break. Also knowing that within myself, I'm only a human being, you know, something might just trigger where I could just bang, pop, and do what they say, what they call squeaky booting, hit the bell during the night and head out, you know what I mean? Thankfully, I didn't have that strength, and it wasn't only my own strength, it was the strength of all the other blanket men around me. You know, we all leaned on one another, although there was walls dividing us.
But then sometimes it just comes a point where some of the people who, down through the years, left the protest, who you just were amazed because you'd been there in wings with them, you maybe shared a cell with them, you knew what their attitude was, but it just comes to a point where they just, in that moment, can't take any more. And at the start, there would have been probably a fairly cruel response to it, but I think as time went on, then people realised that it could be them the next day, you know, so there was a bit more of understanding, a bit more empathy shown, you know, in later years.
Outside the prison, people mobilised in support of the prisoners. Relatives' action committees were to the fore in organizing street protests to raise awareness of the prisoners' plight. Across the country, support slowly increased. But within the H blocks, in cells of 8 by 10 feet, with only a small window and a steel door which was locked 24 hours a day, the men could only rely on each other. The H block construction did, however, have one redeeming feature. Sound reverberated.
You actually used to visualise movements and other things in the wing here, but with your ears, you used to hear the screws coming on here and the jingle of the keys every morning, the footsteps, and even the squeak of their boots could have been heard a mile away.
Once the screws left the wing, they left about 7:30, 8 o'clock in the evening. It was nearly as if the wing took on a new life. Even though nobody was moving anywhere else, they were still in the exact same cells and everything, but there was more of a communal existence then, you know.
It's important to remember that in a H-block wing, there was up till maybe 40 prisoners. So you can rest assured there's different people brought different things till the entertainment in those wings. There was always people whose morale was always up, and other people sometimes their morale wavered, it was up and down. It was just, that's just human nature.
Sing songs have been organised, poetry, books, and that in itself was an escapism in itself, because, you know, you could actually switch off, you know, you lie in your cell and just close your eyes and just me be in a different world, you know.
It used to be groups formed within the wing, and people used to be turning around and playing the water gallon in the cell as a boron. Tomboy Loudon here, he was actually in the cell with me at the time. Tomboy thought he was a good boron player.
If it was half full, you get a different sound, because half of it was missing, you know. And I was hurling, I was beating the thing with my thumb, and Adam was singing out the door. So we had a competition. One week it was called Stars in Your Eyes, right? So what we had to do was give the fella that was doing it at Mass on Sunday, everybody just had to hand him a name, you know, your stage name, what it was, and he would just call it that night, you know, Pixie and Dixie, which was me and Leonard. We got up and do our wee stunt. Leonard was singing, and I was beating the boron on the drum, and thought we were brilliant, doing all these Dixie numbers. And he would call the other lads, you know, you had the Screaming Skull, you know, the Gruesome Twosome. You know, these are all different names the lads picked, and when they were called, they got up and done their thing, and then we had a vote to see who was the best. Well, obviously, me and Leonard did in a minute, like. So.
You had Jake Jackson, good at reciting poetry and stuff like that there. Martin Hurston, Lord of Mercy on him, one of the hunger strikers who died. Martin's morale never wavered. He was next door to Richard, myself, and Hurston Boy, as we called him in the wing, was always up for a song, but undoubtedly he was the worst singer in the world. There was nobody could sing worse than Hurston, but when he got up for entertainment value, he was brilliant. He got the whole wing up banging the doors when he'd finished his song.
It was a new man come on the blanket, we had a sing song. And there was one fella come on, a mate from mine too, from the New Lodge Road, me and Paddy Byrne said. So we started a sing song that night, and I was doing the camper, and I was calling all the singers. And all the lads were all singing like mad the whole night. And then maybe it came to Paddy Moe's turn. And I said, "Right, Paddy Moe, it's your turn." He said, "I can't sing a song, Tom, but me, I have to sing a song. I mean, this is your first night in the blanket." And I said, "All the lads is sung for you and entertained you all night, you have to sing one." He goes, "Well, I'll try one, man." And the whole wing was dead quiet. And this thing you heard, "You're once, twice, three times a lady," right? And lads were going, "Gee, oh." He's still singing to me. I mean, "Paddy Mo." He goes, "What?" He goes, "What's the fuck's that you're singing?" He goes, "Three times a lady." I said, what's three times a lady?" He says, "Number one in the charts, sung by Lionel Richie." "Yeah, mate, we haven't heard the charts in 4 years, and you're singing, but Lionel Richie out the door does? Get away from that door." And the abuse he got out the door, the lads were all rasping, we call raspy, farting them out the door, like, "Get away from that door, Mo." And he said he sat there with a big, massive grinner, he says.
I mean, while you could sing or not, you get up to the door, you talk a bit of abuse, it was a bit of slagging, but it was all part of morale building. You know what I mean? It was all part of bonding together, you know.
In 79, they moved a group of us up to Heat 6, and Bobby was one of the ones there, and that was the first time I was in a wing with him. I mean, getting him up to do like a solo concert was brilliant, and I often thought about a heapy stand there. This was 79, this was one of the coldest winters that there was. And we'd be lying there up against the pipes trying to get warm and have blankets around us, whereas he's standing on a blanket at the door singing. But singing the songs that he wrote, the really sad song for Susan and Michael Hatton and such like. I think the morale there came from seeing that this was songs that had been created in the jail and then sung by someone who was still in the jail. So it's always about overcoming the barriers that, you know, the system's trying to put up against you.
When Bobby came onto our wing, I don't think before that we'd done a book, as they called it, and say for people who had read a book, a really good book, then they would get up and they would get maybe an hour at the door, and everybody would settle down. You would get yourself nice and comfortable, your feet against the pipes or whatever, get a couple of blankets around you. Some people may have pulled their mattress right up the door so as they could hear it. But seeing the quietness in out in the H blocks, you could hear a pin dropping.
There was times where you'd have maybe walked all day, so you were sort of a bit tired, you'd lay down. Or there's times you'd have been standing, maybe the windows, say, there was very little you could see out the window, but that bit of sky you could see, you could sort of look up and maybe an out bright night out of stars or something, saying, you know what I mean? You'd have maybe stood there just basically staring into the sky and listening to the book and trying to like, put yourself into, you know, setting yourself into the scenes where the book was. It was relaxing, so it was like chill out time for blanket men, you know.
I used to tell a story here for an hour and a half, and then all of a sudden he'd have shared it down. Because the wing here was that quiet, he'd have shared it down. And we'll get dinner here, and the colleague will fight. Is everybody asleep yet? And if I hadn't been any response, he'd have just finished the book then. And then he'd have come back here the next night here and continued on. He actually used to give a wee brief rundown about what happened here the night here before, just in case anybody fell asleep here during it.
4 years into the protest, and with no resolution in sight, the prisoners decided to bring matters to a head. On 27th of October 1980, seven prisoners refused food and began a hunger strike.
We, and my six comrades, are prepared to go through with this, and we are prepared today to prove that we are special prisoners and our five basic demands are just.
Come mid-December, and with one hunger striker close to death, secret negotiations appeared to deliver the prisoners' key demands, and the strike was frantically called off. The job of briefing the apprehensive prisoners on the settlement reached fell to Bobby Sands.
I remember getting up on the pipes and seeing him coming back in, and everybody was just excited and waiting, but didn't know, we hadn't a clue, we hadn't heard anything. And I remember him coming down, he went into his cell, I think he was in with Tomboy Loudon at that particular time. I remember him getting up the door and outlining him what had happened, and that he'd been round all the other blocks, telling us that there's a document coming and we'll just see how it goes. But and I remember just, you know, well, that's good, let's see what happens.
There's not a blanket man in Ireland alive today with sort of, I forget it was. We got word in, there was a victory march up the Falls Road, and the darts down the other upper road, victory for the blanket man. At that stage, we had nothing, you know, so we were saying, well, something must happen, something must have been, the victory march to the Falls Road, this march that happened. You know, so everybody's sitting this and that there, and then as things sort of way settled down and things started to come through, and then most of what we were just told, bang. We were stroked, the Brits reneged on every single thing, and I mean, it was just like my guts just dropped clean out.
The British document fell far short of the prisoners' demands. In a game of brinkmanship, the British had outmaneuvered the prisoners.
Morale here took a dip. I actually know here minds here took a wee bit of a dip, because I actually thought here with the first hunger strike, if it failed, we had nothing else here to fall back on. I wasn't the only one here thinking that way. I would say here the majority here people probably here thought the same way.
I mean, it was one of the things here, and you had to sit back and just reflect, where do we go from here? Bobby Sands was the man who came back down and told us what was going on. Bobby Sands came back in and sent word back through the wings again and saying, we're going on hunger strike.
On the 1st of March 1981, Bobby Sands embarked on hunger strike. This was to be the final chapter. Relatively unknown to the general public, Sands had been the officer commanding of the IRA prisoners during the first strike. In a short time, his name would be famous around the world. To his comrades, he was the embodiment of resistance. From the outset, he was certain of death.
That Sunday of Masses, everybody's over them, fucking shaking hands on them, wishing them all the best, and then back this cell night, and he read it. And it was all about, you know, that he knew that this has to be done. You know, we can't let this linger on and go on the way it's going. We have to move now. And he was, I know there's a great possibility, he says, that I'm going to die. He was, but I hope and pray, he says, that I'm the only one that dies. I hope I'm the only one that dies, he says, and it'll be brought to an end. And I don't want you to worry about me, no less, you know. And he said, don't worry, he says, the Republic's safe with me. I heard the screw shooting. That's transport for sands. So at that time, we were using the toilets. You could shout and get out to go to the toilet. So I shouted, cell 22, toilet. And the screw down my door and let me out. Just he let me out. Bobby was coming out of his cell, the thing, and all the lads were shouting at him. All banging the door. So I went up and got a hug. Two of us hugged each other. Yes, I'll see you, mate. I said, I have a thing about you. And yes, that was it. That was the last I seen him.
In a bold move, Sands was put forward as a candidate in the Fermanagh South Tyrone by-election. The other nationalist candidates stood aside to give him a free run against the unionist candidate. For the first time, the popular support for the prisoners was to be put to the test.
During his election, we'd had a radio, a wee crystal set, which my wife Jean had smuggled in, and I'd brought it through on a visit. And it was probably one of the most uncomfortable things ever, having to smuggle something like that, while there's a screw stand in front of you. She had to get it out, and then I had to get it up my ass and bring it back.
I was in the cell with a lad from a new lodge road, Paddy Burnside, right? And Paddy Moore, really, he'd only limited Irish. And I hear probably had a wee bit more here Irish than him at the time, right? Once the result from Bobby Sands' by-election here was coming in, if he won or lost here the election, there was to be no response whatsoever within the wing. It was actually in the afternoon, and I was pacing the floor, like everyone here in the blocks, and wee Paddy Moe was saying, asked him here, is it through yet? And I was shouting through, and Milian Fogel here, go for it. Is there any word yet? And they were shouting back in Irish, Milian Fogel, right? There's no word. The tension here was mounting, and we were pacing up and down the floor. And I'll never forget this. I heard the guy here getting up. I think it was PV Coyle, right? And he got up and he shouted, Cail O'Marty. My chin here nearly hit the ground. Paddy Moe here looked at the reaction to me and he says, that's bad news, isn't it? I says, yeah, we're lost. To say we're nearly crowned here would be an understatement. We were absolutely...